service is led by the Reverend Ernie Ray. Here on FM, it's our Book of the Week. Sian Thomas continues to read My Life in Houses, the author Margaret Forster's journey through the houses she's lived in and loved. Today, Forster's family have managed to move away from the increasingly run-down Raffles estate to a slightly larger council house, where the bookish young Margaret seizes upon a room of her own.
The council house we moved to in October 1952 faced Carlisle Cemetery. It didn't depress me in the least. The cemetery was just a park to me, full of hidden paths crisscrossing between the gravestones. And the house itself was an undeniable improvement on the one we'd just left. But the condition it was in was not. The famous indoor lavatory, so longed for, took bottles of bleach and hours of repeated vigorous brushing before it was anything but disgusting. My mother, who of course had left Orton Road immaculate, was almost hysterical. Slowly, very slowly, the house was licked into shape. But funds wouldn't, as yet, stretch to having the black range fireplace removed and a modern fireplace put in. Then one day, my grandfather, George, arrived while my mother was doing the black leading. He'd come on the way back from visiting his wife's grave in the cemetery, standing there until my mother appeared and asked him if he'd like a cup of tea. There would be an awkward moment or two when, if he was in an expansive mood, he might make some comment on the weather, and then he'd turn and go. But this particular morning, when my mother didn't appear, he came into the house and saw her on her knees doing the blackleading. He returned later that day. My father went to the door and came back with the startling news that a new fireplace would be put in the following week. It was something called an Osborne all-tile fireplace, complete with steel grate. Oh, rapture! I'd never seen any beauty in the Black Range, which to me stigmatised the house. When the new fireplace arrived, I was as admiring as everyone else, failing entirely to see how cheap and ugly it was. The suspicion was growing that my grandfather was going soft in his old age. He made one of his unnerving appearances one day, while I was sitting in the parlour with a board across my knees writing something for homework. He said nothing, of course, but an instruction was later received to be in Tuesday. I was at school, but when I came home I was told by my smiling mother to go and look in the parlour. Grandfather George had bought a bureau. It was new and shiny, and had a leaf that let down so I could use it to do homework, and set the tone for what this house and this room was to mean to me. A place of study. What years those were, 1952 to 1956, each one heavy with ambition and determination to do well at school. Leaving school with my bike wobbling, the basket in front so weighed down with books, a girl once jeered, "You're a swot." And I nodded. Yep, I was a swot. A teacher had mentioned university to me, and though I only had the vaguest idea what a university was, the thought of being able to leave home and go there appealed to me. All it was going to take was concentration and hard work. There was no self-denial involved. I liked the studying. Every evening, I sat in the parlour and worked my way through homework and then some extra reading. It was lucky that in this house I had a room to study in and was no longer banished to a freezing bedroom. I actually had a fire there, a gas fire in the corner which spluttered and hissed alarmingly. I'd hear my father saying to my mother, "Has she got that fire burning money again?" But I was never told to turn it off. If any other family member dared to come in, I'd look indignant. Didn't they realise this room was dedicated to scholastic endeavour? Once the all-important A-levels were over, in the summer of 1956, I emerged like a tortoise, slowly creeping into the kind of normal social life my mother thought I should be enjoying. The group activity I got into was fell walking. This was boy-led. We would set off on Friday evening, stay in a youth hostel, walk all the next day, stay in another youth hostel, then come home. I loved it. I began to treat our house the way so many teenagers do, as a place to go and get a hot bath and good food, or, in other words, as a hotel which didn't charge. My A-level results came out in August 1956. They were good enough for me to be allowed to return to school to sit the Oxford and Cambridge entrance exams. It was a big risk, because if I failed to get a place, I'd have wasted a year. And by then I had a distraction from my devotion to studying. I'd met, that summer, a boy called Hunter Davies, who was in his second year at Durham University. But I went ahead all the same and sat the exams. I was full of gloom by the time the telegrams came offering me an exhibition at Girton and a scholarship at Somerville. I don't remember feeling thrilled so much as relieved. Taking those exams had seemed such a gamble. And I am not a gambler. My room in Somerville College was in the library block, built in 1903, along the northern perimeter of the grounds. The room was roughly three, maybe four times the size of our living room at home, and I struggled to fill it. I could see that this room was, in fact, quite shabby, but its very shabbiness was somehow grand. I felt aware all the time of those who had gone before me. The carpet bore the marks of many feet, and the bedspread was frayed through use. The table had had ink spilled on the surface, and when I looked closely, I could see scratches, initials, along the rim, which I couldn't quite make out. Outside my room there was a door leading from the main part of the college to the library. The slap of the door opening and shutting, and the sound of voices as people swept through it, disturbed the otherwise intense hush. I supposed I would get used to the noise outside, the ebb and flow of the human traffic, but I never quite did. Somerville was an attractive college to live in, but I just didn't like being surrounded by other people. I'd always fantasised about going to boarding school, the sort of school featured in Angela Brazil's stories, and I'd imagined a college to be a blissful version of this, which I would immediately love. Instead, I longed to escape. I was given permission to look for lodgings, though these, of course, had to be on the college's approved list. One of my friends, Theodora, found the two rooms we were to rent. The house in Winchester Road was a small 19th-century terraced cottage, and we went to look at it, and to be looked at by the landlady. Mrs. Brown was sitting in her front room, waiting to receive us. She was straight out of Jane Austen, wearing a little lace cap on her white hair and a shawl round her shoulders. Mr. Brown, we assumed, must be dead. Mrs. Brown had rules, which we eagerly agreed to, none of them at all troublesome. Then she dismissed us with a slight wave of her hand into the care of her sister, Fanny, who would show us the rooms. Fanny was very different, small and plump, with wild white hair pushed back from her face, and she smiled all the time. Whereas Mrs. Brown was elegantly, if quaintly, dressed, Fanny wore a wide apron over a blue dress which reached almost to her heavy black shoes. She, all friendliness, chattering away and addressing us as Miss Margaret and Miss Theodora, showed us the two rooms we were to have, one at the front of the house and one at the back. The front room had a gas fire and a gas ring, big enough to manage to cook scrambled eggs, or at least make cocoa. The back room, mine, was less than half the size, and looked out onto a yard, but it had a real fire, which I was told I could use if the weather was exceptionally cold. I loved Winchester Road from the moment we moved in. It was an odd set-up, but we fitted in surprisingly quickly. Fanny did all the work in the house, commenting loudly on whatever she was doing, often with what sounded like resentment towards her sister. "Sweep the whole floor," she says, as if it wasn't damn well swept already. We tried very hard to keep on the right side of Fanny, aware that it was she, not Mrs. Brown, who really ran the household. There was also a third person living there, Reg. We never knew his surname, and his relationship to both these women went unexplained. He was an elderly man, we reckoned about 70, but of course, to 19-year-olds, he looked ancient. He shuffled around the house all day, with Fanny bawling at him to bring the damn coal in, or get on with them potatoes. Doing these jobs meant, we thought, that Reg could not be a paying guest. But if he wasn't a lodger, what was he? The highlight of his week was Saturday evening, when he went up to the attic where he slept, and after a bit of shuffling, we'd hear a rhythmic pounding of his feet as he sang, "Yo-ho-ho and a bottle of rum." Did he have a bottle of rum? We hoped so. It was perhaps a kind of contradiction that I loved the house and my room in it. It was extremely small, and since I'd complained for years about feelings of claustrophobia at home, you'd have thought I'd have felt this even more strongly here. But I thought it snug, not cramped. Inside the cupboard, where I hung my clothes, there were some coat hangers covered in pretty material and with a little lavender bag attached. I imagined the dresses which had once hung there, the sprigged cottons, the fine muslins, but more likely the drab grey and brown of servants' dresses. It was the sort of room that nurtured and encouraged the imagination, especially with the fire lit, flickering away and creating those shadows which could be turned so easily into people. Lying in bed in a winter's night, with just the bedside lamp on, that room wrapped itself round me as securely as the old-fashioned eiderdown. If I'd believed in ghosts, that is when I could have convinced myself the room was suddenly crowded with them. All women or girls, sighing their way to my bed, their long hair unbraided, their white nightdresses catching the dying light of the fire's embers. I'd grow dangerously sentimental before I fell asleep. I was married from Winchester Road on the 11th of June, 1960, disappointing Fanny by not looking as a bride should. No long white dress and veil, no bouquet, no grand car with white ribbons streaming from it to carry me to the church. No church, either. We were married at the register office in St Giles, with Theo and Mike, an old friend from Carlisle, as witnesses. Already that day in June 1960, when I left Winchester Road, that house had started to become a memory. I tried to cling on to the feelings my little room had given rise to, the sense of security and calm it seemed filled with. And then, of course, there had been many happy hours there, sneaking Hunter in, while Fanny pretended not to be aware of what was going on. But I knew I'd just been an interloper in the house's history. Theo and I passed through it, gone in a flash, like so many other undergraduates. I never went back. But then I didn't go back to Oxford until 28 years later, and then only for the day.
Tomorrow, the wreck that becomes the family home, as Shan Thomas reads more of My Life in Houses by Margaret Forster. It was abridged by Sally Marmion and produced by Justine Willett. After the news, Woman's Hour continues its special week of programmes where all the topics have been suggested by you. Today, the effects of refuge closures on women and children escaping domestic abuse. When is the right time for grown-up children to leave home? And the challenge of finding attractive shoes for big feet. Woman's Hour with Jane is in a couple of minutes here on Radio 4.
Our player leaves on the line and...
Overrunning engineering works.
iPlayer being told,
your call is important to us.
For the 50th time. iPlayer, the conversations you don't want to have while on your only tea break of the day. And iPlayer ending up in the wrong queue at the supermarket every single time. BBC iPlayer. BBC Radio and TV, always there when you need it.